in that science fiction movie, I vaguely remember they went into partial orbit around Jupiter, deployed that thing as a method of doing braking. So it looks like that method of aero braking was part of a science fiction movie quite a few years ago. WS2N, K2RAW.
Yeah, that was the 2010 movie, the follow-up from the 2001 original Space Odyssey. And they used a balloon to float themselves down as they aero-braked around Jupiter. But yeah, it's the same type of thing. It will increase the diameter. And this one uses, pressurized, a nitrogen type of gas. Not exactly nitrogen, but it'll blow up bags completely surrounding the circumference. The 8-meter one, when that comes out, somehow they're going to utilize the air itself as they're coming through the atmosphere to increase the volume there without using some kind of charge on the inside. So that's just a different type of design. Same idea will create this blow-up bag, increase the diameter situation. But and the reason they go up that high, they want to get up, they'll start off 23 miles high and then go even higher with the rocket, 4,000 miles an hour, is because that's where the air is really rarefied here on Earth, similar to what you would find, lower to the ground. At Mars is, 0.1% atmosphere.
I've got a problem here, though, Paul. Let me drop for a second. Any of the heat shields we put on our Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo spacecrafts are very high temperature devices, because when you're moving at a high velocity and hitting the air, you get a lot of shockwave compressive heating. People used to call it friction. And therefore, the surface becomes very hot. I'm having trouble believing that this balloon material can tolerate those high temperatures. It must be a pretty exotic material. Over to you, Paul, K2LAW.
I think the heat shield works first, slowing it down. And then when it gets to a certain speed, around 4,000 miles per hour, don't forget it's coming in at 13,000 miles per hour from outer space when it comes into the Martian atmosphere. Not like here when it's coming in here from a different planet, it's coming in at 25,000 miles per hour. This is 13,000 miles an hour. It slows, the heat shield will slow it down to around 4,500, drop off, and then this balloon thing will pop out, slow it down to, it'll still be supersonic, but, it'll get down to, maybe 800 miles an hour or something like that. I think I remember even up to 1,000, and then this parachute will pop out, this extra large parachute, and that will do the job the rest of the way in there.
Okay, my other basis of comparison now is the SR-71 aeroplane. At 80,000 feet and 2,200 miles an hour, the air hitting that aircraft at only 2,000 miles an hour creates numbers like 600 and 800 degrees of surface temperature on the aircraft. So I think you're telling me the balloon can tolerate those kinds of temperatures. Over to you, Paul, K2RAW.
Yeah, but what was the air pressure with the Blackbird, the SR-71? This air pressure is 0.1%. What was the pressure on that?
Very good point. You and I can look up what is the air pressure over the Earth at 80,000 feet. And so quite possibly the Mars atmosphere is considerably less than that, particularly the top of the Mars atmosphere. It's going to be pretty tenuous stuff before you get a hell of a lot less heating. I see it coming. Okay, I believe him. Okay, Paul, over to you, K2RAW.
Yeah, these guys at JPL better be right. They go out to Kauai, Hawaii, that island, Barking Sands, where they test this thing. And then, that's one of the islands. It's northeast of the big island. And that's where they have the Navy base. In fact, that's where they're going to launch this rocket eventually, the Strife rocket that will go into orbit. So they have a testing range out there, and that's where this thing got to be launched from. And they're spending a lot of time, money, years of their life trying to develop this thing. So, I mean, they really believe they need something like this to eventually land large, heavy payloads on Mars. And Curiosity is 2,000 pounds. They need, now to call out a ton, they need 20 tons, you know. they need something real big. Wanted to mention the OSIRIS-REx is now being funded and actually is starting to build this. They were working on this for a couple of years, too, trying to get it approved. And what this thing is, they want to launch a rocket to an asteroid, go down and collect some material from it, very little, from what I see. But, you know, you're looking at 2 ounces or more. You want to get that material and bring it back home. So they plan on now launching this thing 2016, next year, September. Go out to an asteroid. By the time it gets to it, Bennu is the name of the asteroid, B-E-N-N-U. And it'll be out there around 2018, going to orbit for, a long time, months and months at a time. But they'll go down, grab a couple of bounces, and then bring it back and not get back to Earth until 2023.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Has done it already. Booster spacecraft, they went out, did a similar type of thing. Well, a lot less than back, you know, almost like, you know, way less than a couple of ounces. They did succeed. And then they sent another one, Booster 2, out last year, around December. And they're going to do a similar type of mission. And, they use their ion engines on it, everything. I'm starting to see duplication here, but I really figured out why we're doing it, outside of the fact that it's good practice to eventually do what they want to do with the arm mission, they call it. That's where they'll go out and big asteroid and put it in lunar orbit. So, I mean, it's kind of like practicing for that in a way. But it's been funded and they're getting ready to do that.
Okay, Georgia.
Here, Eric. Go ahead. QEJWS. Go ahead.
I just wanted to make sure you guys can hear me, although there's somebody off plan on there.
Thanks.
We're hearing you rather well, Paul. By the way, the Eastern machine, when I transmit to it, it's working like a charm, but the link between the West and the East seems to not be there. You're probably aware of that, but I'm just double-checking and letting you know. KE2EJ, K2RAW.
No, in other words, you're not hearing me come out of 8.5?
Yes, I'm hearing you beautifully coming out of 8.5, but our 8.5 signals were not coming out of 3.75 before. Oh, I'm coming out of 3.75 now. You've restored the link. Well done, Eric.
All right, well, that's just phase one. All right, I got a couple more things to do. This may interrupt you again, so just be patient. Remember that I'm doing it.
Not to worry. We'll learn to live with it. Keep up the work, Eric. WS2N, K2RIW. Paul, so it's all ionic engine after it leaves the Earth, I have the impression, the OSIRIS-REx 2016.
The Japanese one.
Oh, okay. So when is ours going to be launched, Paul?
That'll be launched from, Cape Canaveral. And then September of next year. We'll see it that way. But, what a name they got. I think somebody must sit around dreaming these things up. You know, they call it OSIRIS-REx, so they come up with this name. Origins Special Interpretation Resource Identification Security Regolith Explorer. you know I wrote that one down, Dick. But they come up with these names. Really not much else. We do have a CRS-6, that's a SpaceX mission, coming up. They delayed it again. It was supposed to go up Friday, you know. So it's delayed to April 10th. They went over to April 13th. It was April 10th. And we'll see how that one goes. That should be interesting. I hope they have good weather and good seas, because they plan on trying to bring that booster back again. First stage booster back to the autonomous ship. And as you know, last time they almost succeeded. They hit the ship, kind of like crashed on a 45 on sliding across the deck. Left pieces all over everywhere. But maybe this time they'll luck out a little bit better. They added a lot more hydraulic fluid to it. And they were in short of a hydraulic fluid last time, and that's what caused the problem. The other thing I want to mention is the large hydrant collider thing. I don't know if it went back online and today. It's been shut down for 2 years. Back to you. Any questions, you or anybody else? Dick, K2RIWWS2R.
The LHC, Large Hadron Collider. I believe they're now going to boost to a higher magnetic field and be going to a larger energy of impact. Do you happen to remember what's the new number they're going to be going for? I think they found the Higgs at something like 126 gigaelectron volts, if that was the number. And so after this most recent upgrading, I believe they're going to go to a much bigger number in the next year or so. Do you happen to know?
They're going to double it, Dick.
Fantastic. So do you happen to know what number is going to be the target this time, Paul? The first two N, K2RIW?
No, in fact, I forgot what it was last time. You would have asked me, I would have said they were instead of terabolts, but not gigaelectron volts. Weren't they up into the terras?
Well, quite possibly John knows. Hey, John, what's the number they went to before, and what's the number that you think they're going up to, even though they're going to double this? You got it, John.
Dick, I don't remember. I read it a couple of days ago, and they said they were going to double it. I was watching a program, a little snippet that was about maybe 20 minutes about the Hadron starting up, and they said they're going to double the power, so, and they're very excited about it. But I don't know what the KVA is going to be.
When it comes to this mission on the International Space Station, where one astronaut is staying on the ground, these are identical twins, and one's going to be up there for a year, and they're going to be comparing how much bone density loss takes place, how much muscle mass changes, and I know that the human body is really designed to be in a 1G gravity environment, with the 1G most of the time pulling the fluid down to your feet, and the body does a pretty good job of fighting that fluid going back up. And you put a man in space, and most of the time his face will look very puffy. He'll look like he was suspended upside down on Earth, if you know what I mean. And so one of the mechanisms of eye damage, you and I were discussing this a little bit a week or two ago, Paul. Let me drop. And I think it was Roy who sent me an article or told me the fact that part of what happens is the extra fluid pressure in the cranium when you're in a weightless environment does create a bit of grief, where a small percentage of the people, the extra fluid pressure in the head causes the fluid to crawl down the optic nerve and deposit itself behind the retina. And so that's one of the mechanisms by which changes in vision takes place, because of being in a weightless environment for a long time. I think you and I were discussing this. We didn't quite understand the mechanism. I was making guesses that a person becomes farsighted because the eyeball changes shape and or changes size. But the fluid crawling down the optic nerve apparently is one of the mechanisms that I guess is going to be investigated. And I think to find a drug to stop that happening is not going to be easy. WS2N, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
Yeah, I haven't heard about the nerve problem. I know about the higher, well, not higher pressure, but the fluid, the ocular fluid. Because without the gravity, it's not the same shape as whatever it is on Earth. It's supposed to change your vision, but I haven't heard anything. You know, the nerve thing. I do understand it's permanent, though. They come back and have this problem, so it sounds like maybe something is getting in there. Behind the nerve, behind the retina. Doing something. Hope it doesn't lead to macular degeneration. That's a real problem. Two different types. What type and the dry type. Long-term, I guess, 2-3 years in space. Maybe will lead to more understanding of this. Right now, they're doing 1 year in space. See what happens. A lot of problems, a lot of things to work out. They should have developed a Nautilus system. That was a spinning thing. You could have put a bunch of these modules together, have them spin. Spin your way all the way to Mars. Some kind of half a G gravity or something. That would have been good.
And I think this article I read recently, that is one of the speculations, Paul. If the zero-G or microgravity situation creates these changes, which in some cases might be permanent and difficult to tolerate, like bone mass loss and changes in vision, and maybe the vision changes are permanent, when it comes to long missions like the so-called planned mission to Mars, we may have to create artificial gravity by creating modules that rotate. I think that was also present on one of the Space Odyssey movies. I think they were in some kind of a rotating object that went to the moon. Do you remember that section, Paul? Looks like that particular science fiction was pretty far ahead of its time. WS2N, K2RAW.
Yeah, I know that movie came out in 68. And, they had the space station spinning, going around Earth. But where they had that, I mean, that looked like it was pretty high up. They never said how high it was, but, I mean, it looked like that would have been in the Van Allen belt. They weren't low enough as far as I'm concerned. The craft that they used going to the moon was around big round sphere. And that did not have artificial gravity. They had a thing where you could, you know, when you stood in one place, you would turn upside down, you know, enter one room to the other. But no artificial gravity on that. On the Discovery, they called the Discovery craft that went off to Jupiter. Yeah, they had that was spinning. I remember the guy, they used to practice running, jogging. Thing. Well, same type of thing. They've developed. Bigelow wants to do it. He's got a launch coming up at the end of the year. He's putting his habitat module on SpaceX, and they're going to attach it to the Tranquility node on the International Space Station as a test for a couple of years. But he wants to take a bunch of these things and NASA had plans for it. It was called the Nautilus Project. And it would have, half a dozen of them, and it would have been spinning center of a spacecraft as it goes off to Mars. And, you're in these modules. You'd be able to sleep in there and at least get, 8 hours of gravity. That might help. Back to you, Dick.
In that Space Odyssey movie where the actor Care Dulia is running on a track like this great big circular thing, he's running around that circle, and I presume it also was rotating, giving him artificial gravity. Think about the fact that if he ran in the direction of rotation, he would see more gravity. If he ran opposite the direction of rotation, he would see less gravity, and if he ran fast enough, he could create microgravity. He could create zero G, depending on which direction he ran on that circular track, which I believe was rotating. I don't think they covered that factor during the movie.
Quick note, Dick.
Go ahead, John.
13 tera electron volts was just sent over at Golika.
I presume that's the number that the new Large Hadron Collider in CERN, Switzerland, is going to be going for. And I guess the Higgs boson was detected at a considerably smaller number. I thought I remember the number, but obviously I don't. Okay. And by the way, the only way they can get to these higher energy collisions with the Large Hadron Collider is they got to move the objects faster, so to speak. That really means you give them more artificial mass as you approach the speed of light, and it takes stronger and stronger magnets to do that. Can we drop?
And Switzerland will go dark.
Not necessarily. It doesn't necessarily require more power, Paul. Yes, you're tuning the magnets to a higher current, but because they're superconducting magnets, once you get them up to that current, once you get them up to that magnetic field, no further amount of power is required. I think they do it by pulsing them. I've never found that the exact way that you bring your superconducting magnet in a MRI machine up to the speed, and I think it's done by pulsing. See, you come up in steps is my guess. And so, even though they're going to tune them to a higher magnetic field, the good news is you can now move the particles faster and get a bigger bang, bigger collision. The bad news is now the total amount of stored magnetic energy is greater. And when you had that meltdown, so to speak, that occurred a few years ago, where the resistance of a joint left superconductivity, went into ordinary resistance, therefore it got hot. Because it got hot, the whole darn magnet lost superconductivity, and you had to quench the whole damn magnetic field, and all of its stored energy comes roaring back to you, whether you want it or not, and it created a lot of damage. Well, right now, when you go to twice the magnetic field is what I think is going to be required, twice the number of Tesla, I think that means the total amount of stored magnetic energy is at least twice. So they better make sure that all of those joints are in very good shape, because you've now got a higher risk factor. Does that sound reasonable? I'm going to pass it over to you, John, and then over to Paul in that order. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Yes, Dick. In fact, this information is being sent over by mic number two. At 13 tera, they expect to be able to capture dark matter. That's what they're looking to do. And if I remember correctly, I believe it was around 7 tera electron volts. So now 13 is almost double. So they're looking for some good information out of this.
Okay, let's see if mic number two is available. K1MJM, are you online tonight, Mike? K2RIW in the TechNet?
Roger that, Dick. This is K1MJM.
Hey, tell us where that information is coming from, and tell us a little bit more about it. 137, or is it 13? I can't read my own writing. Either 13, I think it's 13 tera electron volts. And I believe that requires, for twice the energy, I think it requires twice the magnetic field, twice the amount of stored energy. Therefore, they better make sure they really have those joints tied down, because if we get a quench now, it's going to be maybe twice as destructive. K1MJM, K2LAW in the TechNet.
Roger that, Dick. Yeah, I'm online. I'm just searching the science website and picking the data off and pasting it into EchoLink, and whenever John sees a good time, he's interjecting there. I don't know any of this stuff. I'm just finding it from the various websites.
Good stuff, Mike, and thank you. So, Paul, it's too bad the United States, who was the leader at one time, and the superconducting super collider that we were building in Texas was going to be roughly twice the size of the Large Hadron Collider. But our Congress decided that they wouldn't get enough bang for the dollar. And I guess at the time, we hadn't yet perfected superconducting magnets. And therefore, they were worried that the project would turn into a boondoggle if the magnetic field development didn't proceed at the right rate compared to the construction of the rest of the machine. But it sure would have been nice to have that machine in the United States, because they've already done a terrific amount of construction. I think the whole thing was going to be something like 100 meters in underground and roughly twice the diameter in Texas as the one in Switzerland.
Quick note, Dick.
Go ahead, John.
Dick, as you realize, the Second World War wiped out most of the scientific research being performed in Western Europe. And in 1954, I think CERN started this, and they've worked up to this level. But yeah, it's been very expensive, and it's been a long time, but they sure have captured the world's imagination.
And the United States is a participant in that effort, and some of our physicists and scientists are over there contributing. But so we're not the leader in the particle accelerators. And it looks like we're not going to be for a long time to come. We're not putting our shoulder to that particular wheel. WS2N, Paul, you got anyone to add to all this? Large Hadron Collider, K2RW, you got a Paul?
One other thing, Dick.
Go ahead, John.
Do you know the reason why the Large Hadron Collider had to be so large? Such a great diameter?
My best guess, John, is that the strength of the magnetic field required is a function of how much deflection you want to create. As you try to create the exact same amount of energy of a smaller diameter, because the smaller diameter is a larger amount of curve, let's call it, you need stronger magnets. And it's a more difficult tuning process to have the magnetic field just right, see a particle stay in the middle of that, let me call it a piece of waveguide, that's my words for it, the vacuum tube. So the smaller the diameter, the stronger the magnets required, and you get a law of diminishing returns. So the bigger the machine with reasonable size magnets, the higher energy you can go to. That's my understanding of it, John. KC2WGB, K2RW.
You're absolutely right. It was a trade-off. They took the medium. They said, you know, protons, they want to go straight. They don't want to go in terms of that. You're right. They need a tremendous amount of magnetic effect to cause them to go in a circle. And that's the best they could do with the money they had. Ours, I believe, would have been a lot larger. But what we would have found, I don't know. Maybe it's better that Europe is doing it, and they seem to be doing a good job. But yes, because of the magnet design, that's the only thing they could afford. They had to make it that big. You're right on target.
Thanks, also. You got it, Mike. Roger, this is K1M Jan. I was just reading. There's a lot of other things to help support. And it's drawing many peers and scientists from the world are migrating to that area to support this and function.
Yeah, CERN Switzerland right now has a very large, a lot of the brain power of the world has gathered there. And has anybody made a prediction as to how long CERN intends to be in operation? Do we have reason to believe that that effort is going to go on for at least another 10 years? Has anyone ever quoted that along those lines? Anybody who's got knowledge, go ahead and answer. K2RIW.
WS2N.
You got a poll.
When this started coming out, oh, I don't know, 5-10 years ago when they were building this, we're getting close to first turning it on. It's got to be about 5 years now, right? They said every couple of years they would shut it down, just like what they did. It's been shut down for 2 years, and then rebuild it and always make it more and more powerful. But they never said that there was going to be an end to it. Yeah, the one in Texas would have been over 50 miles. They put like $1 billion into it, and I thought that was. I mean, they were starting to build it. Bush wanted to shut it down. I was surprised. He's from Texas. But plenty of jobs into Texas, but he shut it down. So I don't know what happened there. What a shame. Back to you, Dick.
At that time, $1 billion sounded like a lot of money. Well, we put something close to $8 billion into the Shoreham nuclear station. We didn't get very much in return. And during the recovery, the economic recovery of 2007-2008, I think the total amount of money loaned was something like $800 billion. There are people who will always say that why are we going to space? Why are we doing pure research? We got all these problems on Earth. Why don't we solve those? If you took all of the money of the space program and gave it to every man, woman, and child, it'd be something like $157, I think we calculated a couple of weeks ago, you and I did, Paul. And if you give every human being $157, the United States is not going to solve all their problems. I doubt it. And there's various kinds of mathematics that'll confirm that when you do investment into pure research, you don't know what you're going to find, but at some time later, you almost always find use for it. Knowledge is power. And so searching the unknown, you've got to do a certain amount of it. You can't stop that. There were past history. Let me drop it. There's past history of societies that said, hey, we're going to shut ourselves out from the outside world. We're going to stop all this progress. We're just going to concentrate on our own efforts. I think China did that some ridiculous number of years ago and set themselves behind, so to speak. You've got to be seeking the unknown. It creates passion, curiosity, knowledge, progress, and it eventually turns into consumer products. A high percentage of the things that NASA has done has turned into better consumer products. I think they say we get a 5-to-1 return on our dollars with NASA as far as new products and putting people to work. Isn't that roughly the number, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
Yeah, that's about it. I know NASA's budget is $18 billion. And then I know we talked about it a lot, so I found out that the defense budget, you know, for our country is $700 billion. So there's a lot of money there, Dick. But $18 billion is like nothing compared to the $700 billion that they got. So, at least when you know they have a launch with an Atlas satellite with the X-37B, that's the one that the government defense puts up there. That's been going for about 3 or 4 years now. It's on its third flight. Gonna do a fourth flight. It's like a little space shuttle. It comes down, lands on a runway, and all. And then none of that money is coming out of NASA, so that's good. That comes out of the defense budget. And there you go. You know, I mean, you know, Russia's putting they have a like $100 billion defense. We're $700 billion. It's a big difference. We got a lot of money in defense.
Comment, Dick?
Hey, John, recognized. The $18 billion that NASA's budget is at right now turns out to be $54 per human being in the United States, $54 per year. That's the price of one Starbucks coffee per week. For the price of one Starbucks coffee per week, you can be supporting NASA. I'm positive we're getting our money's worth. I spend more than that on just cat food. Lots of people, I guarantee, spend more than that on just their cosmetics. To cut off NASA to say that we can better spend the money some other way, if you're very naive, at first it sounds good. I don't accept that. Oh, he's John, KC2WGB. He's going to buy 2 coffees per week. K2RIW, you got it, John.
You mentioned $150. I mean, that's buying a quality tire for your car, basically. I would be more than willing to have them deduct $2.50 a day. That's a day. For a year. Approximately $1,000. Okay. If it was going to go to space research like we're planning on doing, just think of the younger generation coming up, how much opportunity that will give them to a drive to get an education, to get involved in something serious. Instead of this dilly-dally crap that we have going now. $1,000 a year dedicated just to the space program. I'd be willing to pay it.
$50, I was wrong. It's only $54. Right now, the space program is costing the American public $54 per year, per human being. I'll admit that's every man, woman, and child, but still, as I said, it's the price of a Starbucks per week. And I think I spend, I know I spend more than that on just cat food. So I'm not going to give up my cats, and John and I, we're not going to give up NASA. Paul doesn't really support NASA. He thinks we should be saving the money, but let's see if we can talk Paul into supporting NASA. WS2N, K2IW, you got a Paul.
Okay, well, we've got to figure out what our hourly wage would be if we were in the commercial world here. And that would there. We'd take up at least an hour a week on the net. So what would that be per week and then per year? Wow. A lot of money, Dick. Let's see. I'm thinking about the cost of, we have three rovers on Mars. One quit at Spirit. Opportunity is still running. Curiosity, of course, is still running, the new one. But they want to stop, they want to pull the plug on Opportunity. I mean, you know, what could that cost per year to have people sitting in a control room operating this and programming it? They want to pull the plug on it there. Also on lunar reconnaissance orbiter, which is going, it's in polar orbit around the moon. They want to pull the plug on that too. I mean, you know, what does it cost to get another one there? And that kind of logic I don't get. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I think I read that in the process of pulling the plug on Opportunity on Mars and the lunar orbiter, that money is going to be put into, and they named the other project, and I forgot it. You probably name, you know the name of the new project they want to put that money into. Paul, go ahead.
Well, whatever money it is, it's not all that much. It's just for people communicating with those robotic spacecraft. So, no, I can't imagine what they're going to use to, first of all, I don't even know how much money you're talking about for something like this. But whatever it is, you know, even if it's, $10 million or something to pay these people to do their jobs and program the spacecraft. So, I mean, what percentage of that is of the $18 billion? It's peanuts. Back to you.
Some of the really big, exciting projects right now are the James Webb Space Telescope, which I think gets launched 2018. And I believe it's a number of times larger than the Hubble Space Telescope. And it's an infrared telescope, which is going to be able to see a lot further, look through the dust clouds. Also, the 30-meter telescope, I believe, is under construction. I think the biggest telescope we have in operation right now is the 10-meter. I think we've got a couple of them scattered around the world. I believe one of them is located at the European Southern Observatory in Chile. And I'm not sure, but is that the location of the 30-meter telescope? But the 30-meter telescope, with its adaptive optics, and I think it's the latest issue of New York Times Sunday issue. It's got a beautiful picture of it, or was it last week? It's got a beautiful picture of this thing. It's going to, on the ground, have twice the capability of Hubble. So, when it comes to telescopes, let me drop this. Bigger is always better. We used to think bigger wouldn't do you any good because you're still looking through that turbulence at the upper atmosphere where there are sodium ions running around and they will flash back at you and that becomes an artificial star. And now you tune this flexible mirror 1,000 times per second, and I think they can even tune it faster than that, in order to correct for the ripples in the atmosphere. So with adaptive optics, you can now have a telescope on the ground that's larger and higher in capability than Hubble. The slight disadvantage, of course, is that doesn't have the complete freedom. You can't aim at the backside of the Earth at this instant of time, so to speak, whereas with Hubble you can. But still, well, I take it back. We all think that something in space, particularly if it's in orbit around the Earth, which Hubble is, let me drop it. If each one of us drew a diagram of the Earth and then where Hubble is located, and this is one of the Veritasium videos, Derek Miller went in and investigated. He interviewed a number of students that are in college right now studying science, and he said, this beach ball represents the Earth. Show me with your finger where the Hubble Space Telescope is. And they came up with huge diameters. And where is the moon? They came up with very small diameters. They didn't understand how far the moon is away compared to a beach ball. And in the case of the atmosphere around the Earth, it's really an extremely thin atmosphere. If you made a scale model of the Earth by using an apple, the thickness of the skin on the apple is the thickness of our atmosphere. And the Hubble is just barely outside of that skin on that apple. So when Hubble is in space, and you think you've got complete freedom to aim it everywhere, versus a telescope on the ground, the difference is fairly small, except for one factor. Hubble is in orbit around the Earth. So he's going to make, I'm guessing, around 13 cycles per day. So you do have more freedom in space. But maintaining very high technology, let me drop. Maintaining very high technology in space is not easy. Each individual repair mission to Hubble is a pretty good fraction of $1 billion by the time you do all the practice, create the hardware, go out there and install it. Am I in the right ballpark on those numbers, Paul? And as such, $1 billion spent on a Earth-based 30-meter telescope located in a place that's got extremely thin, dry atmosphere, like you do in those mountains of Chile. I think you get a lot more bang for your money on the Earth once you solve the problems of the squittering of the signal coming through the atmosphere. So I think each repair mission is a good fraction of $1 billion to Hubble. Isn't that true, Paul? WS2N, K2RAW.
Yeah, I thought it was 500 million. I thought it was a half a billion, but I forgot. That's a while back. Last service mission was 2009, and there were five of them, so including the first one, to actually make the repair. One of the ones that Story Musgrave was on. But, Hubble is, what, 8 feet? I'm not going to use meters. 8 feet in diameter, roughly. And James Webb is roughly 21. Interesting thing about the mirrors, though, you know, the technology has changed. The mirror in James Webb is primarily made of beryllium. It's very lightweight. It's very strong. And the total weight of the mirrors, compared to one another, is Hubble is actually twice the weight of the James Webb mirror. You're comparing the mirrors. So, time marches on. So, it's going to be infrared, but it can see in visual light, except it's not going to pick out the blues because the gold on the mirrors, that kind of like reflects, you know, it rejects the blues. Back to you there.
I think that was KC2RFN. Go ahead, Alan.
Just to back up for a second, were you about to make the point that the difference between the ground-based telescope and the Hubble, which is in orbit, is that the ground-based can't really see behind the Earth and the Hubble might, but then you sort of were going to back off because the Hubble's not quite as high as we thought and the Earth still gets in the way. Were you going to make that point, or is it just listening on the wrong tack?
Yeah, you caught me, Alan. I created a lot of confusion here. Yep, the Hubble is very close to the Earth. So therefore, at any one instant of time, you can't aim it in all 360 degrees of azimuth and elevation of space. But Hubble is in orbit around the Earth. So you just wait an hour and it's going to be on the backside. So you've got a lot more freedom of aiming Hubble in space than we do ground-based. However, it's a lot less expensive and a lot easier to maintain a ground-based telescope. And the 30-meter telescope, which I think is under construction right now, is touted to be able to have twice the capability of Hubble when it comes to resolution. Accutance, resolution, sensitivity, by way of adaptive optics. The adaptive optics is able to almost cancel all of that distortion you get from the atmosphere. Let me drop this one other thing I was going to mention here.
Question, Dick.
Go over to John in a second. When Derek Mueller, the guy who makes these Veritasium YouTube videos, science videos, there's about 100 of them, they're very good, he asked a bunch of college students, assume this beach ball is the Earth, and assume that this tennis ball is the moon. How far should the moon be away from the Earth? And it turns out the moon is 60 Earth radii. Take the radius of that beach ball, multiply it by 60. That's where the moon is, away from the beach ball representing Earth. Almost anybody draws a diagram and gets those dimensions way too small. But when it comes to locating the Hubble Space Telescope above that beach ball, it would be a fraction of an inch away from the surface of the beach ball because the atmosphere is so darn thin. Whenever we draw a diagram of our atmosphere, we don't realize the atmosphere is, the majority of the atmosphere is 6 miles high. The Earth has a radius of 4,000 miles. It's close to a 1,000-to-1 ratio between the radius of the Earth and where the atmosphere goes to, the troposphere, the major portion of the atmosphere. Of course, you've got to locate a satellite a little bit higher than that, but these dimensions are kind of crazy. KC2RFN, K2RW, go ahead, Alan.
Okay, I follow that, Dick, thanks. And I actually have a question that comes to mind from the movie Gravity. Maybe you or Paul could jump in on that, but should I ask it now or wait till later?
Yeah, let me pick up John first, and then we're going to come right back to you, Alan. KC2WCB, K2RW, you got it, Alan. All right, here we go. You got it, John.
KC2WGB. Yeah, just a quick question. You said 30 meters. 970 feet, if my calculation is right in my head. Is that steerable?
30 meters is a little bit over 90 feet. 95 feet, I think, is the number. Absolutely. Fully steerable. The Sunday section of the New York Times, that's what I think I was reading. I've got it sitting on my table. I think it was last week's Sunday New York Times, has a picture of the 30-meter telescope, an artist's conception of what it's going to look like. Fully steerable, going to be located in Chile, on the top of that mountain range. Over to you, John.
Okay. All right. Yeah, my head calculation was wrong. All right. Back down.
Right now, our biggest mirrors are 10 meters, and there's a few of those in operation. 30 meters is, roughly 10 times the area. Could say potentially 10 times the sensitivity, and 3 times the diameter is 3 times the resolution. We're not yet at the point where we can really look at an exoplanet. Well, we're pulling your leg. You've got it, Alan. K2RIW.
I'm just thinking of this because you had brought up the reality that Hubble is really pretty low in the Earth's orbit, and I assume so are the space stations and where our shuttles have floated around. But in this movie, you probably know the basic premise. There's a catastrophe and there's debris spreading around the Earth, and it causes all sorts of trouble. But one thing I don't understand in the movie is that this Chinese space station. First of all, I don't know, is there really a Chinese space station? But in the movie, you actually see it beginning to deorbit and begin to get into the upper atmosphere and start to break up. And I don't understand why that would happen. Why, even if something was hit in space, would it have to deorbit? Why would that happen? Even if it's getting smashed up, I don't see why all of a sudden it would deorbit. You actually see Sandra Bullock getting pulled downward with it, almost like she was in the water being pulled down with an anchor as they were re-entering the atmosphere. And would that really happen? You know, is that just a little license to make another scene in the movie?
WS2N.
Paul recognized, I haven't seen the movie, Paul, Alan. However, from what you're saying and my understanding of physics, I agree with you. You've got a good sense of physics to know that that is crazy. In order to create a significant change in velocity of a object in orbit, in order to change its orbital altitude, making a significant amount of change of momentum, kinetic energy, velocity, call it what you like, you're going to apply some amount of force from, say, a rocket for some amount of time, like minutes in many cases. And so for a simple impact to do that, your simple impact of an object hitting your spacecraft is going to break off the side view mirror. It's going to poke a hole in your spacecraft. But the total amount, I mean, that object is impacting you for milliseconds because it's coming at you at high velocity. It's going to roar a hole through the side of your spacecraft and go right out the other side. So the impact is a lot of force for an extremely brief period of time. Therefore, the total change in momentum is not large. Could you, with a simple impact, take a large object and deorbit? I say no way in hell. Not unless you smash the whole damn thing, so to speak, or something really large. So that part of it doesn't make sense. And on top of that, if she's part of that spacecraft, let me drop this. She's part of that spacecraft, and because any change in spacecraft velocity creates a change in altitude 180 degrees away in orbit. In other words, if I'm directly over the United States right now, so to speak, and I make a change in velocity, I'm going to create an increase or a decrease in the change of altitude on the back side of the Earth when I get there. And that's just the way orbital mechanics works. And so you wouldn't know for some period of time, if you change the velocity, that you've got a brand new altitude. And with that brand new altitude, if you start touching the top of the atmosphere, the first thing you're going to experience is heating of the surfaces. As the top of the atmosphere, those molecules are hitting you at 17,500 miles an hour. They're creating heating. And so the first thing you'll sense is some heating. Way down later, when you start digging into the atmosphere, you'll start feeling some reverse thrust. So for her to suddenly sink because of an impact, we're going to send it back to you, Alan, after Paul gives us his words on this. And I think they've made a number of errors there. And they try to hire good science people when they make movies like that, and they almost always get a few of the things wrong. But getting better, they get a few things wrong. WS2N, K2R, give you. Go ahead, Paul.
Okay, yeah, good movie, Alan. But yeah, the Tiangong Space Station. It's a Chinese space station. It's flying around up there right now, but they're not going to have any more people go to it. They've had a couple of crews go up to it and dock with it and stayed with it for a couple of weeks and then left. So, yeah, that's their first prototype, and then they have a Tiangong 2 and a Tiangong 3 eventually. That will go up. This was the first one was a monolithic one, the one that's up there now, meaning that they didn't plan on sending up progress type ships to it, and you know, no dual docking ports. You could load the thing up with garbage, but then all the astronauts would have to take it out, so they didn't have a progress ship to resupply them or get rid of that type of an arrangement. Similar to what the Russians had in the early space station days during the Salyut times. Let me drop it. Salyut, 3, 4, and 5 were monolithic type, and then when they got into 6 and 7, they had dual ports, and it was more advanced. And that's what the Chinese plan on doing on their next space station attempt. in a, you know, in that movie, that thing was well along. That was into the third version. The other problem is, she went from one place to another. You went from the Hubble Space Telescope with a backpack all the way to the International Space Station. You know, way different altitudes and different inclinations. That was impossible to do. Good movie to watch, though. It's fun. And then she had to get to the Russian space station. As far as the space station deorbiting, they made it seem like since it wasn't manned for some period of time, it is true. They like the one that they have now will eventually deorbit, but it's going to take many years for that to happen. Just like the original Salyut space stations eventually deorbit, and they learn a lot from that too. They learn that we have to control these deorbits when they happen. It could go anywhere, like Skylab. Skylab was a roll of the dice wherever that thing went. Back to you, Dick.
Well, I didn't see that movie, but it's with a backpack. She went from the space station to the Hubble, or vice versa. Out of the question. Huh. If you burned up every bit of fuel you've got on Hubble, on the International, here we go, on the shuttle, you can only make a couple of degrees of change in tilt of orbit. Turns out once you're in orbit, you really are like an extremely large gyroscope. And to tilt the plane of orbit is very difficult. So to go to some other orbit, at some other orbital plane, and then at some other altitude, and then meet up to have the co-elliptic and everything come out just right so you arrive at the new location. That takes a lot of planning, a lot of fuel, and boy, they did a lot of poetic license on that movie, if that's what they did. Other than that, did Sandra Bullock play a good part, Alan? KC2RFN, K2RIW?
Yeah, she did, Dick. I thought she did a great job. They picked a good actress for this one, and it was a very entertaining movie, if you could suspend your disbelief. But it was just things like that disturbed me. I don't know if in the movie it seems sensible that the space station might be near the Chinese space station because they could help each other if they needed to. But they were only, I think it was 100 kilometers apart, and all she had to do was, I don't want to ruin the movie for you any more than I have, but it's really more about the visual than it is about the storyline. But that I just found hard to believe, that they're so close that they could have enough energy to make it to one another as easily as driving across a parking lot. And it just so happens that the Chinese station was starting to deorbit just at the time this freak's, occurrence and catastrophe happens, I think they ask a lot from a modern audience. And it gets even worse. Paul, you might remember when... She's in the Russian deorbiting. I don't know what that device. The device to get back into orbit. Let me just drop. And she's listening in on just a random radio frequency, I assume, and she picks up a baby monitor of somebody talking, and it's just so absurd how she's going to hear a baby monitor. And, they're both going to be able to hear each other, perfectly. Another one that strains the belief of, certainly any ham radio operator, that's for sure. But I think it's worthwhile seeing before I blow the rest of the movie for you.
That's when he was in she was in the Soyuz craft first, okay. Very good. Not the Shenzhou crash. The Shenzhou is the Chinese one.
If you're looking at a spacecraft that's ahead of you, like the space station or the Hubble or whatever, and if it's, let me pick a number, a few hundred yards ahead of you, and you blast your rockets so that you speed up in that direction, that will work. However, if the distance between you and the other spacecraft is such that a reasonable amount of speed up is not going to allow you to get there until you've gone through a quarter of an orbit, so to speak. You've got to do the opposite of common sense. You blast to a higher velocity in order to catch up with something that's ahead of you. Within a quarter of an orbit, you're now going to go to a large